Well, good day and welcome to the Disaster Podcast. I'm your host, Jamie Davis, the Pod Medic, and it's great to have you all here. We are going to be picking up with part two of our special vertical medicine resources episode we had with Dr. Seth Hawkins and Pierce Bessinger. And it's great to have these two guys on because they are among the best experts out there in vertical medicine and indeed wilderness medicine resources. So we want to make sure we get the rest of this episode in here. Special thank you to Paragon Medical Education Group for their continued sponsorship of this episode. We also had Dr. Joe Holly from Paragon on the show, and he shared some of his insights with us as well. And of course, my esteemed co-host Sam Bradley was also joining us. So let's jump on in here with the second half of this special episode segment with Dr. Seth Hawkins. And we pick up with Sam's question to Seth about what he's trying to do with developing some sort of credentialing and standardized certification for vertical medicine, vertical rescue responders.
So do you see, I'm trying to get a sense of how you're building this thing, Seth. Are you looking to create like a certification course around these standards and protocols?
Well, the interesting thing is that the certification courses are out there, and this speaks to the difference between certification and credentialing. So I could certify you, you know, you could take a course with Pierce and I, and we could call you credentialed in super cool mountaineering paramedic.
You mean certified in super cool mountaineering medicine?
Right.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. Even better.
And that would only carry as much weight as me saying that that was a meaningful training, but to the degree that you could actually use the skills that I was training, and you need to be credentialed by a state to do it. So it's really a two-pronged, you know, approach. One thing that I think Pierce and I are personally doing is just trying to fit into the standard of care that's evolving organically through these schools creating their own credentialing courses. And there is a standard that's evolving there just by the way standards of care evolve, that there's a consensus perception about what should be done. But the really big challenge for us, I think, is getting state regulatory organizations like offices of EMS to recognize that this is legitimate practice of medicine, and then building scopes of practice around that. So I think we may have spoken at a previous podcast about the great example of dislocations where a vast majority of wilderness medicine classes would teach the skill of reducing dislocations in the field, but the vast majority of state offices of EMS would not permit EMS personnel, even at a paramedic level, to do that skill. So you have this real discrepancy in what's first aid and what is the practice of medicine. So that's something that National Association of EMS Physicians is trying to do, to try to create some of that credentialing. But a lot of it is standard of care. So, you know, I think an interesting question for Pierce would be, you know, if this happened on Mount Hood and it was, you know, within the jurisdiction of a response team that was acknowledged, I think, by the state to be a legitimate mountain rescue team, how would Portland Mountain Rescue interface with a group of physicians and off-duty firefighters who were, you know, providing ad hoc care if they had to merge their operations for 2 or 3 hours before a helicopter got there? You know, to what degree would Portland Mountain Rescue step in and say, we're now standardized healthcare providers doing this. You know, we're going to do it this way in the face of physicians there who might have a different perception of what should be done, but it was not in their jurisdictional authority and we're not technically activated to do anything. Like maybe it's a physician from North Carolina who, you know, isn't even licensed in the state.
I'd be happy to speak to that. So Mount Hood is a really interesting mountain in how it's governed from a search and rescue and medical response type system. The mountain itself has a county line running right through it, and so on one side you have the Hood River Crag Rats, and on the other side you have the Portland Mountain Rescue, and then you have the Timberline Lodge Ski Patrol, which also, you know, handles response. And then you have a rescue team associated with the ambulance service called the RAT team, or Reach and Treat, which will do their best to climb up the mountain. So you have all these different parties, all with a different physician providing oversight for the team. And then each team having its own medical committee, which, you know, does, you know, not morbidity, mortality conference, but sort of a peer review process for each event where there's, you know, care that has been given. And then you have the state sort of and far off land with their regulations and how they view each team and at what level that team functions. And so it's not infrequent where an event will take place where Portland Mountain Rescue will be activated. The ski patrol will already by default be on scene. The ambulance service is driving up to the mountain to get their people up there. And everybody has to pick a different role and operate within sort of that sort of microculture. And that culture exists as you know, one subset on Mount Hood, which may look completely different on Mount Rainier or another, you know, pick volcano XYZ of the Cascades, and it's going to look a little different. And then you throw into the mix that you have a psychiatrist who happened to be trying to climb the mountain that day, and you know, they had their personal medical kit, which happened to have, you know, drugs XYZ, which don't fit in anybody's medical protocol, but are a reasonable solution to treating, you know, the whatever the diagnosis of the day is. And then everybody has to play in the same sandbox or snowbox for that matter, and make it happen to take care of the patient. So there's a lot of dialogues, and I think Seth mentioned, you know, the various certifications are out there. It seems that most of those groups that will offer reciprocity, you know, if you needed to have a recertification, will say, yes, we will recertify you if you were certified by, you know, another agency. We'll offer a recertification in so long as that previous certification had a minimum number of training hours associated with that. And so perhaps that's the standard that we look at in the future is, you know, are these certifications meeting a certain number of training hours? And then I guess a follow-up question would be if you have various providers at different levels of front country training, like a physician versus a PA or a nurse practitioner or a paramedic or what have you, how does that backcountry certification translate into their front country job? And does that lend them into a different sort of privileging, almost as if you were applying for hospital privileges and what you were allowed to do or what was considered reasonable to do in the backcountry environment? So there's a lot to sort out going forward. And I think we're just coming into a culture now that's been evolving over the past few decades where there's multiple groups with various classes that are all very similar in training in some capacity, and trying to find some sort of way to standardize that minimum expectations that are consistent with front country care, perhaps with improvised resources, can be, you know, governed, for lack of better words, because I think that's what would need to happen in order to make people feel comfortable that they're all operating under the same umbrella and in the same sandbox.
So, Pierce, when you have a situation where you have these multiple agencies, and that's a really good point, we got all these people wanting to be helpful, but they come from very different places. Is there any kind of, in your specific scenario up on your mountain, is there any kind of incident command structure where a particular agency would be the lead agency and be able to make a call on who does what with who?
How does that work? Certainly is. For us, the Sheriff's Department provides that ICS structure up on the mountain. And in many cases, I've been in a situation where, you know, I work in cardiac surgery, and, you know, I'm very comfortable, you know, for instance, putting in a chest tube or something like that. Well, that's certainly not in the medical protocols of my mountain rescue team. You know, I use a lot of, you know, inotropic and pressor medications in a critical care environment. Again, that's something that we wouldn't use and on the side of the mountain per se. But the paramedics operating under their medical oversight, they might be in that capacity. So where they would not necessarily have to seek out additional input from their medical director in that given situation. If they are on scene at that time, we would sort of relinquish control to them of the medical aspects of the patient, and we would then switch from caring for the medical aspects to the more technical rescue, ropes, patient, and bring them onto a helicopter or whatnot. If it's a situation where they're not available or not on scene, and yet I feel comfortable that it's something that, is within my scope of practice, or I feel, I have a knowledge base to adequately take care of this person, but it's outside the medical protocols, then it's, I make best effort to try to involve the medical director for our team. Even though I'm on the, medical committee, I'm actually chairman of the medical committee. We have a specific medical director, and then the sheriff's department also has a online medical control that we can reach out to by radio. So using the incident command structure, we're able to find somebody who can say as sort of a companion of care, yes, that decision you want to do sounds like a reasonable thing to do. Go ahead and execute it. And then you sort of have a partner who's off scene, but it's still helping out with that.
Well, that's great that you actually have that kind of a system. You have a plan, you have communication. Because sometimes you assume when you're in that kind of an environment, you don't have the ability to talk to anybody else outside of that or to have any level of medical control. So it sounds like you guys have a pretty good setup. What do you think, Joe? Do you have anything like that in your area? Of course, I realize you don't have mountains, but in situations where you might have disparate groups of people coming together like that and...
Well, absolutely we do. It's certainly something we look at from a disaster planning standpoint of when resources are going to be flowing into this area when the big earthquake hits. And, how are we going to manage those people? How are we going to credential those people? Are there, and we have been putting in place ways to expedite the credentialing process, both at hospitals and others, and even assisting hospitals in rewriting their credentialing documentation when it comes to disaster management stuff so that they have a way to expedite those folks, through the process so they can get in there and start taking care of patients.
How about you, Jamie? How do they do things in Maryland?
Maryland has a statewide protocol, and we do have a wilderness EMS pilot that is activated mostly in the western part of the state. But here, when we bring in disparate units, I'm right up on the corner where Maryland meets Pennsylvania and Delaware, and it's not uncommon to have a situation where you have units from another state operating in your on a rescue or motor vehicle accident or something like that, where you need additional resources, and they're the next closest resource. So, in fact, there have been situations where we've had Pennsylvania and Delaware and Maryland paramedics, all with vastly different scopes of practice in realms of what some of them can or can't do, operating at the same time. And what we typically do in those situations is, your unit, your protocols. So, you get a patient assigned to you, then your patient, that's your patient, you operate under your protocols and until you get to the hospital. And that's just how we do it. And if I'm in Pennsylvania operating, it's Maryland in the back of my ambulance.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Well, in California, it's odd, but on the East Coast, you have so many small states. Well, it's sort of like take your small states and put them in California, and we call them counties. But it's almost as though the protocols in one county are so much different from one to the other. And we have those areas like yours, Jamie, where we all kind of come together, and you could have three different, agents from three different counties in there. So it does get complicated. So Seth, where are you going from here? What is your plan from here to try and get where you want to go with this, you and Pierce?
Yeah, so we're the foot soldiers in this effort, in this regard, in the sense that we are offering training and certification, and we would love it if people like that, responders to a mountain environment felt like they struggled with translating those skills they had in a hostile setting to the mountainous environment, and would love to take some coursework. And I think both of us very much at our heart are educators, and that's specifically in terms of our company and the companies like us and the people all around the country doing educational efforts in a sense. You know, that's, I think, the ground level boots on the ground kind of work that we're doing. From a regulatory standpoint, I'm betting that we're going to see a very different environment in 20 years where disaster medicine and wilderness EMS is much more sophisticated as far as a practice of medicine. And, you know, we're in this really weird zone right now, which I've discussed before, where disasters are considered to be something that exceeds the local resources and the ability for people to manage, and yet now we're supposed to manage them. So we'll move past that point to an area where I think we have much more sophisticated disaster medicine standards of care and expanded scopes of practice and operationally specific scopes of practice. And I think that will also be true of wilderness EMS. So the most exciting thing to me now is the same as what it was for me 20 years ago when I first started getting into wilderness medicine, was thinking about the things that could happen to you and your friends and wishing that you knew how to handle it better. And in the case of this particular situation, I think these people just had some pretty astounding levels of care they could bring to the situation, and they had some really innovative thinking that they could do for it. I think that enhancing people who will find themselves in that environment and giving them the tools they need to do what they want to do and what they need to do to help a patient is I think where Pierce and I are motivated, and ultimately where we should be directed from a regulatory standpoint in getting healthcare providers who are activated to do this kind of work. You know, one thing we didn't really, I think, address in this dialogue is, except maybe peripherally, is the unnecessary application of this sort of care, because either, I guess the negative way to say it is because of ego, or just as people get very excited about what they can do and don't really necessarily think through what they should do. So I think, and I don't mean to disparage anybody in telling this story, but I think it was in the national news, so kind of public record, that there was a pretty famous case of somebody treating a pneumothorax in an airplane. Pierce, you may remember this case, with like a Bic pen and like a Coke can. He built it was really cool. It was like from one of my sons loves to build things. He's like an engineer. And from an medical engineering standpoint, I was like, that's phenomenal. He built like a water suction chest tube for this person with a pneumothorax that expanded when they went to altitude in a plane, to which a bunch of people around the country kind of slapped their foreheads and were like, you know, you could have just landed the plane and that would have really helped the situation. So, and Pierce, I don't know if you don't have anything to speak to this, but I think,
well, that was actually me that you were talking about.
Dude, our friendship is over. So. I mean, I think there's a danger of, because you think you can do it, doing it for the sake of doing it, which in everything in medicine, obviously, and that's still true in field medicine, is not necessarily the best plan.
One of the things, Seth, I think that's been helpful, and hopefully will continue to grow this area as we look to having standards of care, is looking at what the Wilderness Medical Society has been doing over the past few years with their practice guidelines and putting that into a sort of a little handbook that they, you know, put together for students of wilderness medicine. And then going back every year or so and adding to that. I know as you're an editor in a lot of the WMS publications, you're sort of intimately involved with this, but those practice guidelines, I think, are starting to form a structural framework that even the state agencies could look to and say, you know, here's evidence-based medicine, here are studies and grade 1A or 2B or 3C indications for this type and level of care. And going forward, I think that will help grow that standardization forward.
Wow. Jamie, you had a thought, didn't you?
Well, I did. And, you know, we're getting towards the end of this episode. And I think that just means that we're going to have Pierce, you and Seth back on to talk some more about this topic and delve even deeper into it. One of the things we'd like to do is talk about the resources, the must-have things that you want to have in your kit for a vertical medicine response. And it occurred to me as I was thinking about this that, you know, we have like our EMS kit and for a standard front country EMS, and then we get into a smaller version of what we need to take with us that we have to have for a wilderness setting or a disaster setting. But then I think about vertical medicine and where gravity really plays an important part in how much you can take with you. It's got to be an even smaller version of the must-have kit. So I'd like Pierce, you and Seth to each share with us maybe the four or five things that you have to have in your vertical medicine first aid kit.
Seth, you want me to go first?
Go ahead.
Pierce, that is so your alley, out like the biggest softball. Please swing for the bleachers.
Okay. Well, I think the number one thing that, and this would hold true for any front country environment, any other wilderness medicine environment, is that very interesting tool that fits nicely underneath the climbing helmet, and that's our brain. A lot of, you know, improvised care and protocols and memorizing mnemonics and things like that are all well and good, but if we don't put our brain into action and try to grasp, you know, the context of what's going on, we're going to miss out on a lot of those situations. And so with the vertical environment, sometimes, you know, just the exposure of being in that environment can be a little overwhelming. And then you add to it a disaster of medical needs, and people can be a little overwhelmed that they, you know, are inhibited and they're thinking through the problem and just getting back to the basics. And so I think that the brain is the most useful tool over all things that you can stick in a chalk bag or on a climbing rack or in your backpack. And so I'll start with Seth and see what he wants to go bring along with him on his vertical journey after that.
Yeah, sure. Happy to take the chalk bag from there. And that kind of leads into a conflict of interest disclaimer that we do sell Pierce and I products with vertical medicine resources that are specifically designed for this purpose, actually literally first aid kits. We do have what's pretty cool, a chalk bag that's a commercially available chalk bag, but we've built in an embedded first aid kit into it. One of the things that I thought was most cool about that was the addition of a sleeve that holds a EpiPen, actually a generic EpiPen is the one that fits this particular sleeve. So increasingly we're facing very high rates of allergic reactions and anaphylaxis. And so my conviction is that you can pretty much always fit a auto injector into almost any rucksack or bag, or even in our case, a chalk bag that you may be taking up on a climb, certainly in something where you're doing an alpine trip, that's accessible. So from a medication standpoint, increasingly I'm thinking that epinephrine is kind of a need to have. And then oftentimes I'll throw in duct tape and a SAM splint. And it's amazing what you can do with duct tape. We, in wilderness medicine, somewhat maybe disrespectfully call it Jesus on a roll, but it does have some pretty divine properties at times for the things it can accomplish. And that plus a SAM splint, which has a aluminum core and a soft external area that splint multiple surfaces, is a pretty remarkable tool. And in that case, I have no financial interest with the SAM splint company, but those form kind of the core of my kit in the sense that you can manage a lot of orthopedic injuries with tape and a splinting material. Epinephrine to me is one of the few things where you need the medication then, and if you don't have it, there's a solid chance somebody could have a fatal outcome before EMS could arrive. So those are core kind of elements to me of a climbing medicine or or kind of mountaineering kit that then you build out from that based on how long you're out.
All right.
Oh, that's great. Oh,
that's great stuff.
I have a couple more things that I would add to my little top 10 list of things to have. A lot of people mentioned the 10 essentials, and I think those still play a role in the vertical environment, and in some cases even more so. But one thing that I think is pivotal in the management of a critical situation is an escape plan. And so what one of the things that we like to put in our kits is a lowering device or a way to lower yourself from the vertical environment. So we include a prusset cord and a rappel ring in some of our kits that can help facilitate getting that person out of the vertical environment and to a place where more front country care might be more readily available. And I think if I was going to finish off my four things to include in the kit, the last one would be some sort of cutting instrument of some sort, because you just can't surpass the need to be able to cut things. And having a little knife readily available is super handy, and is, you know, from a surgical standpoint, since that's where my front country job is, if I'm going to die, it's going to be with a knife in the hand, I guess.
that's great. A great list. Except, Joe, you're going to have to teach these guys about the virtues of a Foley catheter.
I don't know. They got some pretty good stuff there for sure. no doubt many of those items I would include on my list. You know, I we see folks that when it comes to packing medication and that sort of stuff, just I don't know. I think pack a lot of stuff that just doesn't even make sense. You know, they want to carry a bottle of oxygen and that sort of stuff with them. And, you know, I think these guys are right on target. Epi, and, you know, I guess you could consider aspirin and a little bit of nitro, but the idea of carrying a tank of O2 around with you in case somebody starts having chest pain is very old school thinking and not likely to do you much good.
I'd rather have the duct tape.
Yep, absolutely.
Okay, Jamie, all you.
Well, I'd just like to give Seth and Pierce a chance to tell everybody where they can find their resources. We'll have links in the show notes to some of the things that they've talked about. And then, you know, no worries, guys, about talking about your own gear that you guys have. I mean, you're the specialists in this situation that we have on the show, and it's your opportunity to talk about what you do, and we certainly want to hear what you guys have. So where can folks find more about what you guys are doing with Vertical Medicine Resources? Pierce, why don't you take this one?
Sure, I'd be happy to. If you head over to your friendly web browser, you can find us at www.vertical-medicine.com. And from there, you can see various links that will take you to our training courses or our online gear cache of items that we find helpful in the vertical environment that we have for sale there.
Excellent. And we'll have links to that in the show notes over at disasterpodcast.com. So we'll have that there for you guys. And that way people can check out what you guys have, and as well as the training offerings. And if somebody out there is listening to this that is interested in vertical medicine or is maybe a climber and wants to be able to manage a situation a little bit better, they've got resources for you. So we'll make sure that those are linked there as well. And Seth and Pierce, thanks for coming on the show.
Thanks so much for having us.
Thanks, guys.
Joe, what about you guys? Because we talked a little bit about the vertical medicine training, but we couldn't do the disaster podcast without Joe and Jim and the rest of the gang over at Paragon Medical Education Group. You guys sponsor our program, and really this show was born out of a discussion we had a long time ago about getting that type of really good experience out to an audience, whether it's in a training scenario or whatever else. It seems like there are the same things going on in the vertical medicine space as what you guys provide in the disaster medicine space.
Oh, I think there's no question about it. You know, all of these worlds are very specialized. There's a lot of commonality to them, but I think the tools are different. The approaches are different. The problems are different. The processes are about the same, but you know, you have to tailor it for the job at hand.
Well, we do appreciate all your support. And if people want to look at bringing in Paragon to their system or their area to do some of this specialized disaster medicine training, where can they find you guys?
You can find us on the web at Paragon Medical Group or on Facebook by the same name. And our Twitter handle is ParagonMedEDU.
Sam, how about you?
Well, you'll find me on social media under Sam Bradley, SamBradley11, or most certainly on the disasterpodcast.com. And I want to thank you so much, Pierce and Seth. This is I love what you're doing. I think it's awesome, and I really wish you the best of success with it. And please keep in touch with us and let us know how it's going and if you're making some progress on it, which I'm sure you will. And I want to go run out and go climb a mountain right now, but I guess I have to go to Vegas instead tomorrow. But, yeah, please, folks, come over to disasterpodcast.com. I can't believe that you out there haven't got a million questions for these two because they've raised it's just such great information and what it is they're trying to accomplish out there. So feel free to throw a comment up or a question, and I have no doubt we can coerce them into answering for you. And Jamie, where do we find you?
Well, primarily you can find me for this show over at disasterpodcast.com, but if you're looking for me on social media, anywhere, pretty much you can find me under the handle PodMedic. So I look forward to having you guys follow up with me. But most importantly, head over to disasterpodcast.com. Leave a comment on this episode. If you want to have a question for Seth or Pierce, you can leave a question over there in the comments area. It'll show up. I'll be able to respond back to you right away, and we'll make sure they come in and leave a response as well to get your questions answered. We want to make sure that this is a two-way street. So get over there and talk back with us and tell us what you want to hear more about over at the Disaster Podcast site at disasterpodcast.com. You know, Sam, we've heard a lot about austere medical environments yet again this week. And, you know, disaster medicine, vertical medicine, wilderness medicine, it all seems to be leading us in the same direction every week.
And they have another commonality. Disaster medicine, wilderness medicine, and vertical medicine are not your everyday medicine.